Okay, so she's actually coming in.
And Water Committee to order. Today is April 16th, 2016. First thing we're going to do is carry over a bunch of bills to next Tuesday. Those bills are as follows. These are bills that were scheduled for a possible work session today and a possible public hearing.
So doing the today.
Okay.
But we're carrying over the work session.
Okay. We're going to be doing in a few minutes public hearings on House Bill 2983. And House Bill 2666, but we're carrying over the work session on those two until Tuesday. April 21st. And we're carrying over work sessions on House Bill 3211, 3412, 3457, 3367, 3520, 2508, 2741. And we're carrying over the work sessions that were scheduled for today for House Bill 3217, 3221, 3222, 3431, and 2463. So if any of you are here for any of those bills, you're free to go. Now I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3474 and invite Treasurer Wheeler and Representative Reed to introduce that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I hope we haven't scared off the rest of your committee with this concept. I'm here with the Treasurer to introduce House Bill 3474 and the Gutton Stuff -2 amendments, which we hope will allow us to stop making false choices between protecting our environment and funding education. I think you all know that the conflict that exists now, and I'm sure the Treasurer will talk about this as well, the Department of State Lands, which is governed by the Land Board, is constitutionally mandated to prioritize revenue and to maximize returns on Oregon's trust lands. That mandate to provide returns for the Common School Trust Fund becomes an issue when encumbered trust lands, which can be encumbered by federal regulations or lawsuits or a number of other reasons, jeopardize those returns for the Common School Trust Fund. So right now, some of the Common School Trust Fund lands can be losing money for the trust fund, and that means that the problem can persist over time and could apply across a variety of Common School Trust Fund lands. The -2 amendments are intended to set up a simple, easy way for the Department of State Lands and Land Board to transfer trust lands. The bill would give the department a new tool to plan for the future. It's very clear in the amendment that we are not precluding or constraining any existing options that the board and the department have, but rather attempting to give them new opportunities to find creative and holistic solutions when the trust funds are in danger of losing money for the fund. As amended, the bill would establish the trust fund land, the trust land transfer fund, which would allow the department and the land board to identify the lands that might be best for transfer to other Oregon public agencies. It gives the department an opportunity to present to the land board a plan and to the legislature that list of trust lands that they might want to transfer. The land board would need to approve the transfer, and if state money is required for that transfer, the legislature would need to appropriate it. The bill also would create that fund and allow the department to accept outside donations for those transfers, as well as appropriations from the legislature into the fund. It's similar to a program that the state of Washington has run for a number of years with good success. So I want to go really quickly through the structure of the amendments. Section 1 lays out definitions, and we're going to need one additional change here two additional changes, which we hope to have before the scheduled work session on Tuesday. That would be to add tribes in the definition of state agencies for the purpose of this bill and to further clarify the definition of the trust lands. We've been working closely with the department to make sure that works well. Section 2 establishes that trust lands with limited performance potential can be transferred. Section 3 describes how the land board would submit a list of those proposals to the legislature with the appropriate details, and authorizes the legislature to appropriate money for the transfer of that land, clearly stating that it will only be done in a manner consistent with the board's trust responsibilities. And it also states that in addition to the appropriated funds, the board can use other money in the trust land transfer fund for that transfer. Section 4 establishes the fund, which can accept appropriations from the legislature and, as I mentioned before, from outside donations, and that money donated to the fund with a specific purpose or a specific land must be used for that purpose. We think this will allow, again, for creative solutions to persistent and difficult problems. It's not the only tool that the land board would or could use to transfer lands, and it shouldn't be. But by giving them one more tool, we also give them the opportunity to make the most out of our trust land system and to provide a more stable and robust revenue source for our schools. I hope you'll agree that this tool can be a good thing and that we'll be able to see adopt the amendments and move the bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Helm and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the state treasurer. As state treasurer, I'm one of three members who sits on the state land board along with the governor and the secretary of state. The composition of the state land board has existed since statehood in 1859, when the board was established by Oregon's Constitution as the body that would administer the lands that are reserved for the state as part of Oregon's Congressional Admissions Act. Oregon's Constitution further created a trust fund, the Common School Fund, and put the board members in charge of, quote, the sale of school and university lands and for the investment of the funds arising therefrom, unquote. Leap forward more than 150 years to today, and Oregon's Common School Fund has a value of $1.5 billion, and it's slated to distribute a projected $110 million amongst Oregon's 197 K through 12 school districts this biennium. Those are valuable local school dollars that the districts rely on today, and they'll rely on those dollars long after all of us are gone. Oregonians should rightly be pleased with where the Common School Fund currently stands. The Oregon Treasury, under the direction of the Oregon Investment Council, has successfully invested the Common School Fund in a diverse set of assets that have managed to grow the principal nearly threefold just since 1997. Yet, while the fund has grown and matured into what is arguably a significant objective accomplishment, the reality is that there are outside pressures on this fund as well that Representative Reed has alluded to. That's largely attributed to the challenges in natural resource management, which often run squarely into the mandate to maximize profits. House Bill 3474 deals with the reality that there are encumbrances on the land board's land assets that do impede some of the land from meeting its trust mandate. These trust lands have a low income production value and in many cases cost the Common School Fund money, since operational costs exceed revenue generation. The reasons for low income production value are many, including competing uses and demands such as hunting and recreation, steep and unstable slopes, critical fish and wildlife habitat, and other social and environmental concerns. The trust land transfer concept identified in House Bill 3474 would give the land board one additional tool to dispose of these lands while retaining public ownership. As a trustee, my legal obligation is clearly to the beneficiaries, the school districts, and pressure builds to dispose of land that's not meeting the fundamental trust mandate, and it's not likely to do so going forward. Currently, one of the few options available to the land board would be to put that land up for public auction while losing public ownership and other benefits. House Bill 3474 is based off a trust lands transfer model that's been successfully run in Washington State since 1989. It's been run on a bipartisan basis and with the buy-in from beneficiaries and other interested parties. The bill would allow the land board to identify encumbered land, propose the state retain ownership under a different land management agency, independent of the strictures of the trust mandate, and give the legislature control over whether and how the proposal would proceed. That partnership between the land board and the legislature does not currently exist. The result is that the land board has limited avenues to meet its trust obligations. The public trust lands transfer process provides a flexible tool for the state to better capture public land benefits. I ask you to support this bill, and I appreciate the legislature's hard work on tackling this complicated issue. I want to particularly acknowledge Representative Reed and McCune and Senator Roblin for their hard work. And just for the record, while I'm only one of three members of the land board, I want to bring to your attention a letter from Secretary of State Gene Atkins, who is also writing in support of House Bill 3474. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and certainly I'll entertain any questions you may have.
Questions from the committee?
Yeah.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Hill. Well, I wrote it down so that I would ask. Mr. Wheeler, quick question. To myself, where would proper management of the forests that are in the trust lands come into play now, or does this bill have any effect on it? Does it change anything? Is it, do we stay in the same? Do you understand where I'm going with that?
Vice Chair Post through Chair Helm, I believe I understand where you're going with that question. If your question is under the trust lands transfer concept, is there an opportunity to change the actual management and administration of the forest? The answer is yes. It opens up other options from our current scheme.
This bill would. Or
that's it.
Or perhaps,
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, if I might add to it, what we're trying to do is to open up another possibility. And if the bill were in place, the Department of State Lands could identify a piece of land, saying that the collision between these mandates is not working. What's best for the land and what's best for the Common School Fund are not consistent. They could make a proposal to the land board, the governor, the treasurer, and the Secretary of State. We'd like to transfer this land to another agency, and in order to do that, the Common School Fund would need to be compensated, and then if that went forward, the legislature would need to approve it, appropriate the money to do that, and the receiving agency, whomever that is, can then manage the land for other purposes, not just for maximizing revenue to the Common School Fund. That's essentially the scenario. Does that work as an answer?
Yeah, I just, when I hear land trust and common school funds, and then I know that what's not happened in the Elliott Forest, I get a little worried, if that makes sense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, I think it does, and I think that's part of the reason that this haven't happened is the collision of those things, the encumbrances that prevent things that would otherwise generate revenue for the Common School Fund, which is the mandate of the land board and those lands. So we're able to, if this bill goes forward, to separate those concerns. So you could manage the land for the land, which includes timber harvest and lots of other factors, and you can still generate the returns that are mandated for the Common School Fund.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Any further questions? Okay. I have just one. It's my understanding that this bill doesn't preconceive any particular outcome for any particular holding in the state, and I just wanted to clarify that since we have you here. Either one of you.
Yeah, Chair Helm, members of the committee, that is correct. The bill is generic in nature, but it would be disingenuous for me not to say that a impetus for this conversation are the discussions that we're having around the Elliott State Forest.
Mr. Chair, I would say for me, the larger motivation for me is that collision between the mandate to generate returns and the question of what's best for the land in terms of public benefits, in terms of all the good things that can happen on those trust lands, including timber production, and an ability to pursue both of those. So I think that's my motivation. I did also just want to echo something Treasurer Wheeler said. Representative McCune and Senator Roblin have been very involved in this development of this, too, and I also wanted to thank them.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So for folks that are following this hearing, I'm still waiting for a quorum to do some of the work on our work session items. So I'm going to continue this public hearing for ask. Oh, now I have quorum. You're the man of the moment.
Gee, I got moved to the middle. Sorry to hold things up.
We're going to, you know, good timing. So I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3474, but I'm going to get back to it. So stay put. And with that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2723. This is our bill on urban agriculture. We have a dash three amendment, and I would entertain a motion on that amendment.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the dash three amendments.
Representative Post moves to adopt the dash three amendments. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilley.
Thank you. Can we discuss those? Are we intending to move this bill?
I think we're intending to do something with it today.
Okay. I would love to have the dash threes summarized at a point you deem appropriate.
We can certainly do that. Ivan, can you come up and give us that?
Chair Howard, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends and Family Farmers. You'd asked me to summarize the dash three amendment. You may recall we discussed the dash one amendment on the day that we first heard this bill. The dash three amendment is largely the same, with an exception that, and I will confess I do not have it right in front of me, essentially it allows the it deals with on the issue of the buildable land inventories. It essentially says that in the future, when cities are looking at their buildable land inventories, they may at least consider the fact that there are some urban farms within their areas. It doesn't actually require, it still retains a language that says this is purely for tax purposes and not for adjusting urban growth boundaries or changing a buildable land inventories. But nonetheless, it allows local municipalities to consider urban farms in their long-term, you know, vision if they are looking at buildable land inventories. Secondly, the amendment does more clearly articulate that that for the income test on these urban farms, it would be the same as what we currently use for farm tax deferrals for farms that occur on non-exclusive farm use land. So those are the two substantive changes from the dash that the dash threes have from the dash ones that we discussed previously. Thank you.
Any questions? I have one question. I was concerned about limits on the size of the parcels, and I see what I think I see in the dash three is there's still no limit.
Chair Helm, there are no limits, but we've more clearly articulated the income test related to land parcel size is there. So in that respect, it's similar to the farm tax deferral for non-EFU lands currently in place.
One more comment. Okay. Vice Chair Post.
I don't know if they're here or not, but Home Builders Association, Farm Bureau, last I heard from them was on the dash one. Farm Bureau. Do you mind? Home Builders Association, the dash three on this?
This being?
HB 2722.
Builders are dandy. You need me on the record?
No, he doesn't.
And Vice Chair Helm, Vice Chair Post, Farm Bureau still would like to see some sort of sunset in the bill, and I've talked to Mr. Molesky about that, and I think there's some willingness to do it, but I couldn't get approval on the final terms in time for this work session. Okay. So that's where I'm at.
Can we have you identify yourself?
Sorry, Marianne Nash, Oregon Farm Bureau.
Okay. And Mr. Chandler, why don't we get you on the record after all? Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. We're fine with the Dash 3s.
Any further questions?
Thank you. Thanks for everybody working together. Appreciate that.
Could he be a little more brief?
I have to ask this question because I'm not sure that I can vote for this bill without limitations on acreage. So what's going to provide a reasonable limitation on the size of acreage that it's set aside for urban agriculture? I mean, we can get hundreds of acres, conceivably.
Chair Helm.
That is a problem.
Right.
It's a conflict with our policies on urban growth boundaries and dense urban.
Chair Helm, I guess the primary limit would be that these are urban agriculture incentive zones that are proactively established by a city or county. So that decision would essentially be made in somewhat at a local level in terms of whether or not they wanted to designate such zones in the first place, and if so, what sort of the bill allows them to set appropriate limits in terms of local rules, essentially, for what they consider to be small-scale urban agriculture. So other than that, it's similar to the existing farm tax deferral programs that might already cover some urban lands. The key here is really around these five-year agreements and the ability to have the tax incentive more quickly during that five-year agreement and sort of have the certainty around that five-year agreement on these particular parcels that get farmed as part of these zones that the local county or city would designate in the future.
Okay. Any further discussion? Any further questions?
Or did we actually adopt them? The amendment wasn't adopted.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, are there any objections?
To the amendment?
To the amendment. Seeing none, amendment's adopted.
Chair Helm, I move HB 2723 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves HB 2723 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your concerns on this. I'm certainly going to give this a courtesy yes rather than hold it up here in committee with three members absent. Or excused.
Any further discussion? As I said in the previous committee, I think this is a cool idea. I continue to have reservations about acreage, and I would prefer if we could roll this work session over into Tuesday rather than take a vote today to give folks time to convince me that this is going to work, which I'm open to.
Mr. Chair, I respect that, and I think that's what we should do, but I have to say how sad I am that as a Republican I could have made a difference in a bill today. But that's okay.
So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2723, and then I'm going to carry over the work session for House Bill 2723 to April 21st. Thank you all for coming for that. I'm going to open a work session on HB 3214.
We're going to talk about it at all.
We have some Dash 6 amendments, and I let our committee administrator explain those. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a gun stuff, the proposed 6, and it would require the Land Conservation and Development Commission to adopt or amend rules regarding state planning goal criteria allowing local government to rezone land developed or committed to residential use without requiring local government to take new exception to statewide planning goals related to agricultural and forest lands. It requires rules to allow rezoning is allowed only to authorize change, continuation, or expansion of industrial use in operation for previous 5 years. And it specifies restrictions on what rules adopted or amended must provide, and it declares emergency effective on passage.
I'm feeling the same way. I feel like without our whole gang here, I'm feeling amiss, like we shouldn't be moving anything. I don't know if that's even proper, but I just, I hate backlogging us. I really do. But I feel like, you know, there's, I know we have a quorum, but this is important stuff.
Do you have opinions from other committee members? We're going to stand at ease for a few moments. House Bill 3214, and after conferring with our committee here, folks are uncomfortable moving forward with the work session today and potentially reaching a decision with not only our chair gone, but two additional members. So on that one, since it is a -6 and has some complications, we're going to roll that one over to Tuesday, April 21st as well. So I'm going to close the work session on that bill. And at this point in time, I'm hoping to hold a work session on House Bill 3282 as soon as we get our fiscal report, which could occur during the course of the hearing. If not, I will be rolling that one over till Tuesday, April 21st as well. So I'm going to, at this time, reopen the hearing on House Bill 3474. And we have a number of people from over 100 miles. So I'd like to get you up here. Bob Reagan, Chuck Burley, Jake Gibbs. And folks, we are under some time constraints today. And so I'm going to ask folks to try to keep their comments to 2 minutes or less. I've got three huge bills to get through, so I'm going to have to make it two. So I appreciate your cooperation on this. As you know, we're getting down to the wire on our public hearings, and lots of bills and not enough time. Let's go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Vice Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Chuck Burley. I'm the Public Affairs Manager for Interfor U.S. Inc. We own 18 mills in North America, five of which are in Oregon and Washington, one in Gilchrist, Oregon, one in Molalla, Longview, Tacoma, and Port Angeles. We've been involved in DNR timber up in Washington for a while, and I just wanted to share some observations about 3474. We hear repeatedly that we're trying to emulate the program, the Trust Land Transfer Program, in the state of Washington. And there's a few things, and it's in my written testimony. I won't go into the details, but I want to point out a few of the differences between 3474 and the way that the Trust Land Program is set up in Washington, one of which is that in Washington, the department strives to improve returns from state trust lands, a very key element. The Trust Land Transfer Program provides an opportunity to retain identified special trust lands in public ownership, which is what 3474 is doing, while maintaining and improving economic return to trust beneficiaries. And third, the value of the land is used to acquire replacement property better suited to generate future revenue for common schools. And I emphasize that third point because that is the one thing that is completely absent from 3474 and even the -2 amendments. There's absolutely no language in there that talks about using the value of the property to acquire replacement properties. And by not doing that, what happens is the trust corpus erodes over time. What we've seen in the state of Washington, the last report that the department released didn't provide adequate information. So going back to the 2013-2015 program report in Washington State, they reported that there are 60,000 acres common school trust in arrears. In other words, they've transferred out in those 2 years in 13 and 15, 113,000 acres. But they've only acquired 49,000, so they're in arrears. They're not making up for what they're transferring out.
Chuck, can I ask you to wrap up, please?
I'll wrap up very quickly. So my suggestion would be that not only does Oregon need to become more aggressive in managing its trust lands in general, But any program that this state would consider adopting needs to make sure it allows for replacing those lands. And I would submit further, and Washington doesn't have this, that those replacement lands need to be identified at the same time that we identify those lands we're going to transfer out so that we don't have the arrearage issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Right ahead. Who's ready?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Bob Reagan. I'm executive director of Douglas Timber Operators, which is a regional trade association in Lane, Coos, and Douglas counties representing the timber industry. My members have bought the bulk of the timber sales been sold in the Elliott since harvest started in the 1950s. Attached to my testimony is a map that looks like this. That's a map of the Elliott State Forest, and the red part is the burn that occurred in 1868. Burning 300,000 acres in a 35-day span, burning almost 9,000 acres a day. The fire started up here by Scottsburg and burned all the way down to Coos Bay, where it ran into the banks of the bay, and that's where the fire stopped. The Elliott is this black line, everything inside of that. The green parts are old-growth timber, or were, that were harvested early on to pay for the road system. There's a road system on this forest of about 500 miles. Okay, it's a single-lane road with turnouts. The second thing in my attachment to you is a photo taken of the Elliott in 1934. This is not a place where you farm. This is not a place where you recreate. It is steep, rugged country with timber on it and brush. Half of it's been harvested, and as I stated before, there's over 500 miles of roads on this forest. The annual cost of maintaining this forest is between $750,000 and $1 million a year. $250,000 for fire protection costs and another $500,000 or more for road maintenance to take care of that road system. If the road system is not maintained, you'll lose the road system, you'll lose access, the roads will brush over, firefighting costs will escalate, and you won't be able to protect this asset. There's nothing else you can do with this place except make a forest out of it and use it as a forest. There are no developed campgrounds. There are no good access roads to this forest. Thank you very much. I think what you need to think about is whoever wants to receive transfer of this land better understand they have a major cost annually to take care of it.
Great. Thanks, and you're under time.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Jake Gibbs. I am here in kind of multiple capacities. I'm a local school board member in the Oakland School District in Douglas County, and I'm also a professional forester looking at this particular issue with through both lenses. I'm not opposed to the concept of transferring trust lands, but I am concerned about the expeditiousness of this particular piece of legislation and a lot of the details that I'm not comfortable with at this particular time. The first detail, I guess, that jumps out at, that I'm concerned about is the valuation, how we're going to value these trust lands. There's been conversation in the two work group sessions that we had about how that would be done, but no resolution on how that would be accomplished. Funding for this transfer account, where does this come from? If I look at this as a school board member, I want to increase value for monies available for K-12 and the Common School Fund. And I understand, I can look at the Elliott specifically and know that there's value there that's not being realized. Economic value. As Mr. Reagan referenced, funding for continued management of these transferred lands, somebody, some natural resource agency is going to inherit this if this actually were to occur, and it's not going to come at a low cost. And in presentations in the work group that Representative Reed and Senator Roblin and Representative McEwen put together, DSL pointed out that Washington said watch out for that. That was a watch out kind of idea to look for that transfer cost to the addition. That was something not incorporated into their thinking. Maximizing the value, thank you, is important. And how are we going to do that? The term encumbrances has been used by Rep. Reed and Secretary or Treasurer Wheeler, and there's lots of different interpretations and definitions of those encumbrances, and I would argue that we need to make sure we maximize those values going forward. The governance of this particular piece of legislation still resides with the land board, and the beneficiaries don't have another nexus to time in on that. So those are, I sent an email last week when this was originally scheduled, so I hope that's in the record. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Real quick question.
Vice Chair Post.
Chair Helm. Bob, thanks for coming up. All you guys, thanks for coming from so far. This picture is fascinating. I wish I could circulate it to everybody. Would you, in your opinion, which, you know, Bob, I don't mean to poke on your age, but you said 1976 you did, right, was when you purchased for Douglas Timber. I know you probably weren't there in 1934 when this was taken, so but
I do look that old, but
no, you don't. I'm just having fun with you. But would you, you know, this shot, would you say that there is more or less timber there today than this shot as a typical shot of the area? I'm just, it's for my education.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, there's far more timber there today than there was in 1934. The forest is a very productive place to grow trees. It gets lots of rainfall. It's shallow soils, but they grow well. There's almost probably 2.5 billion board feet of standing timber on that forest today. And back when they started the road construction program in 1940 and 1950, there was volume in those green areas, which were old growth, but the other parts of the forest were only like 70-year-old trees. So those trees have grown up to be a good-sized inventory, and that is the value of that forest. And there is no other value for it, really.
Okay, thanks. That was great.
Thank you all very much for traveling today. Next up, Eric Geyer, Heath Curtis, and John Charles. And then on deck, we'll have Josh Laughlin, Pete Sheffield, Jennifer Hayes. And then our final person testifying today will be Tricia Smith. Go ahead as soon as you're ready.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Eric Geyer. I work for Roseburg Forest Products. Here today because I want to talk a little bit about the value of the timber that comes off of the Elliott. Roseburg has been the largest purchaser of timber for many years, and it feeds primarily our Coquille plant as well as plants in Dillard and Riddle, all rural plants with about 2,000 jobs at stake, good family wage jobs. The concern that we have about the transfer is that the elements that are encumbered are not necessarily contiguous pieces, and it would be a very difficult challenge to take those elements and move them to transfer them to another agency while still leaving manageable land. Raises the question, who manages that land, and is there any timber coming off of that? My guess is that the best manager is likely the setup we have right now with Department of State Lands and the manager being Department of Forestry. Secondly, I'd like to ask, you know, just the question of timing. At this juncture, we have an opportunity to expand the option, which we're not necessarily opposed to, but there's no clarity in the details of that, and we have significant concerns about that. And likewise, that transfer would require a significant amount of funding from somewhere else in the budget. And I would suggest that that may be a challenge over the next biennium. So I don't anticipate that that type of transfer could actually take place. And I would ask that you consider the possibility of just delaying this process and being able to vet these things out before moving forward with a bill that may not reflect what the State Land Board actually decides to do later in this year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 3474. While others have spoken to the policy issues, I'd like to focus on some legal questions I have surrounding the bill. As you know, the school lands, including most of the Elliott, are a special class of public land. As styled in the Admission Act, such lands were conveyed to the United States to the state of Oregon for the use of schools. Courts have consistently held that the school land conveyances in the western states create trust relationships and fiduciary duties to the beneficiaries. This is unlike other public lands that serve a myriad of purposes. Rather, the Oregon Admissions Act creates an affirmative duty to manage school lands for specific beneficiaries, that is, the schools. It's also important to note that under Article 8, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution, the State Land Board, and not the legislature, is charged with management and disposition of the common school lands. So, with respect to House Bill 3474, the bill speaks to trust lands that, quote, due to management or regulatory impediments, have limited performance potential as assets of the common school fund. In our view, the State Land Board cannot manage lands into the ground, as they've arguably done with much of the Elliott, and then sell them off to public agencies for pennies on the dollar. This, in our view, runs afoul of the state's fiduciary obligation to manage such lands for the benefit of schools. The better solution is to improve management or to sell such lands to parties who can. Two, as amended, the bill is premised on this idea of a preliminary valuation prepared by DSL. The legislature then approves the funding mechanism sufficient to accomplish a transfer. This funding mechanism is presumably based on the preliminary valuation. It's not at all clear to us that this preliminary valuation is representative of the market price of the asset. It's difficult to know what price the property would bring without soliciting the highest bid. In fact, the statute goes so far as to specifically exempt these transfers from the requirement in ORS 273.275 to seek the highest bid for sales. So finally, speaking as a representative of the timber industry, and as a kid who grew up in rural Oregon, I can't leave without mentioning that these communities have little need for more wilderness and parks. Over 46% of Coos County is owned by federal government, and over 50% of Douglas County is. Managing the Elliott as a working forest not only benefits the schools, it also benefits the communities in which those schools reside. The idea that industrial management of the Elliott somehow compromises the public's ability to recreate or enjoy nature is spectacularly wrong, particularly given how much land these communities are already dedicating to such purposes for free. Thanks for taking my comments.
Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. I'll make a few brief points. First, I think the bill is unnecessary. Anybody in the world could walk into the DSL office today and make a proposal for these lands. And the land board could consider it, and if they are interested, they could have the DSL vet it, and they could decide to do it or not. Nothing stops anybody from making a proposal. Second, I'll just focus on one sentence of the testimony of the treasurer. Mr. Wheeler said the bill would allow the land board to identify encumbered land, propose the state retain ownership under a different land management agency independent of the strictures of the trust mandate. Independent? How does that happen? They have a constitutional mandate to maximize revenue for the common schools over the long term. That's a fiduciary obligation. If the state parks comes in or the Fish and Wildlife comes in and proposes to take the Elliott or any of these other lands scattered all over the state, well, they would have to have money for that. If they come here and you appropriate general fund money, who pays the general fund money? Well, taxpayers, many of whom have kids in schools, they teach in schools, they might have kids in schools, they work in schools, they are the beneficiaries. You're proposing that the beneficiaries buy out an asset that they already own. That's the opposite of fiduciary responsibility. That can't work. The only way it could work possibly is a sale to an Indian, a tribal nation, or maybe the state of New Jersey. They're public. But otherwise, you can't get there from here, transferring to a public entity, buying it out with money already belonging to beneficiaries. So I think, frankly, I've watched the land board over the last 25 years dither on this, refuse to pull the trigger on what was clearly a slow-moving train wreck to do something. Now they're trying to transfer this to this new group. And I say, look, they're the land board. They worked really hard to get on the board. This is their job, to manage these lands, exercise fiduciary responsibility. Just do the job.
Thank you. Any questions for our panel? Thank you. Tricia Smith. Oh, did I get ahead of myself?
Yeah, you have another panel.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tricia, I got ahead of myself. The next panel. Josh, Pete, and Jennifer. Sorry. Okay. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Loramquan, Siusla Indians. My client is very interested in the development of state policy that affects or could affect the Elliott State Forest, which is a part of the ancestral lands that sustained my clients for 10,000 years before the modern managers took over management of that part of our state. The Elliott State Forest, of course, is a subset of the trust lands addressed by the bill that you're hearing this afternoon. And if the bill were to remain as introduced, we'd have quite a number of amendments to commend to the committee. The key point on behalf of my client is that tribes should expressly be considered in the development of or the changes in the way that the state will administer the Elliott State Forest. And we look forward to working with the principal sponsor and with the committee as you work forward to a final product. We hope that principle is incorporated in the language of your final result.
Great.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Helm and Post and members of the committee. My name is Josh Lachlan. I'm the Interim Executive Director at Eugene-based Cascadia Wildlands. We represent approximately 15,000 members and supporters throughout the region. We work to safeguard our natural environment and the outstanding values that it offers us, like clean water, pure air, quality jobs, recreation opportunities, salmon and wildlife habitat, and our unparalleled quality of life. We also work to find lasting solutions for difficult public policy challenges, which is why I'm here today. On behalf of a fairly large coalition I work with, I encourage you to support House Bill 3474, the -2 amendments introduced by Representative Tobias Reed, which would enact a common sense mechanism for the state land board to address underperforming common school fund trust lands throughout Oregon. The bill would allow the state land board, through proposals by DSL, to transfer encumbered trust lands across the state, and those revenues be invested in the $1.5 billion common school fund for the sole benefit of Oregon school kids. I believe that's a win-win for both K through 12 school children, of which I have two in Oregon, and those who value our natural environment and the myriad of benefits that it offers. The trust land transfer approach is not a new concept, as you've heard. It's been used successfully in Washington State for the past 26 years. During that time period, approximately $800 million has been leveraged to move nearly 120,000 acres of encumbered trust lands out of the trust to benefit school kids and the environment. I believe Oregon's got a significant opportunity in front of us this legislative session to create a new tool in managing its underperforming trust lands for the benefit of K through 12 school kids and our environment. I appreciate the opportunity today.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Haynes, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters. The League of Women Voters of Oregon is a nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed citizen participation in government. We have reviewed the summary and text for House Bill 3474, which establishes a trust lands transfer commission to assist public bodies in identifying and developing property interests in trust lands. We support HB 3474 because we believe it will help the state land board to move forward in decoupling the Elliott State Forest from the Common School Fund. However, we also support a final decision that protects the Elliott State Forest for future generations. And I gave you have our written testimony, so I won't take a lot of time to go through it, but I just want to remind you that the League believes that natural resources such as forests and the animals and plants living within them should be managed as interrelated parts of life-supporting ecosystems. Resources should be conserved and protected to assure their future availability for whatever purpose. In part because of our recent water studies, we favor careful landscape management to ensure protection of the rivers and streams, as well as the endangered salmon and other fish in the Elliott Forest. And I'll stop there. Under time, right?
Under time. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Now, and we're going to be moving on to the House to a public hearing on House Bill 2666 next. And let's see, the first folks that are up on the list there will be Sarah. And Sarah, I'm sorry, I can't read the last name. David Engine and Roger Kay. So if they're out in the outside area, they can make their way in. Go right ahead, Tricia.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public and private sector union representing 20,000 education professionals working in Oregon's Head Start, K-12 ESDs, schools, and community colleges. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill, what is the bill number again? 3474 and the Dash 2 Amendment. For about 20 years, I have served on an education beneficiaries advisory group at the Department of State Lands, which, and the purpose of that committee is to discuss policy issues affecting the Common School Fund. It's become clear over the past year and a half or so that we need a statutory process that the department can use and the land board can use when it is faced with a situation as we're faced with in the Elliott. The Elliott State Forest is a treasure in Oregon. It has been for many decades, and I expect will continue to be. Portions of the Elliott Forest are a tree farm, and portions of it house endangered and threatened species. They're vastly different, and they have to be treated differently by the Common School Fund, by the state. Our problems in the Elliott began with the last management plan and will continue who knows how long without a process in place that will help the department and the land board decide what to do with the pieces of it that, whether we like it or not, are not going to be logged in my lifetime, at least. And we think the Dash 2 Amendment is that process, and we think that the concerns that you've heard here today are concerns about what that process may produce and bring to you later for discussion. You can deal with those concerns when those problems come to you. They haven't come to you yet. This process would allow you to be included in those discussions in a more productive way. And we appreciate your support of the Dash 2 Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tricia, you described the need to develop a different system of management for these lands. And I recognize that that your membership has long supported the development of the Elliott and have been leaders in that regard, and thank you for that. Could you tell us what happens if we don't pass this bill and what impacts that might have for your members and for other folks who may be dependent on the harvest of that timber? Economically, what happens if we don't pass this bill?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Witt, thank you for that question. I expect what happens will be what has been happening recently, and that is that it is effectively shut down. We can't use the Elliott in the Common School Fund for its intended purpose because of the presence of threatened and endangered species in part of the forest and our inability to have a process that would help us deal with that part and the other parts. So I think what will happen is continued bitterness, continued fighting, continued federal and state court cases, continued bleeding of the Common School Fund to pay for those lawsuits. I think we need a better, more rational approach than the current approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tricia, I understand that the Elliott State Forest is an exceedingly large component of our trust lands, but my reading of the bill suggests that it's not limited exclusively to the Elliott State Forest. Could you tell us what interest the state might have in retention of underperforming assets out into the future?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Witt, setting the Elliott aside and thinking about the other common school fund lands, off the top of my head, I can't think of other land at present that has the same complications that the Elliott has. But for any of those lands, when it becomes necessary, when the land board thinks that it is necessary or is something that should be considered to transfer, and it's not obvious that transferring in a sale to the private sector is the right answer, then this process in this bill would allow the department and the land board to have a different process in place that they could use to consider how to dispose of those lands or whether to dispose of them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3474. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2666. And I'm going to ask Mary Ann Nash, Rick Angstrom, and Steve Pfeiffer to come on forward. I very much appreciate everybody sticking to the concise testimony. It's helping us move along, and I hope we can get everyone heard today. I just saw Rich. Let's see if we can get him.
Oh, is Rich outside?
Well, he popped in. Go ahead and get started.
Oh.
Keep things rolling here.
So I was actually, for the record, Vice Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Nash. I am the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'm wondering if it makes sense for Mr. Angstrom to present his bill first before I submit opposition.
Okay, very good. We'll then start with Mr. Angstrom.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Let me hold on. Let me tee this up. Because committee, this group of people here and Representative John Davis were asked by Majority Leader Hoyle to work on this issue to see if we could find some common ground between farmers and members of the aggregate industry on how to cohabitate when a new aggregate mine is proposed. And to everyone's credit, they've come together and talked civilly, even though the number of disagreements are great. We don't need to sugarcoat this. The original bill is no longer a topic of conversation. And Rich is going to explain the Dash 1 amendment, which is where it's gone. I really don't want to focus at all it's the Dash 2 amendment, I'm sorry, on the original bill, because it'll take us off in the weeds really quick. So that's where we're at. I'm really happy that we were able to make it to a public hearing today so that these folks can explain where they stand. Take it away, Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rich Angstrom, President of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you today about this important issue. What we're trying to, well, first off, there's going to be a Dash 3, and it's in the works. LC's been working on it, and it's just they're slammed right now. So I know not everybody has been able to see it, but I did send out a copy this weekend to all the parties that pretty much outlined what we sent down to Legislative Council. We're working through the fine details of that, making sure it's accurate and the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. We got rid of out of the bill the definitions that we use, which for what constitutes a impact on agricultural practices, and that seemed to be the most contentious part. The other thing we did in the amendment is we moved the amendment out of 215-296 and it's going to be in another statute somewhere else. But those are kind of technical things that are important in the scheme of things, but not the policy. The policy is, from our perspective, what we're trying to accomplish is when there's a conflict between a proposed aggregate mine site and a farm practice that's out there, that there's got to be a process that's in place for the local governments to follow and resolve the conflict. In 215-296, if you look at it, it sets out the standard, but it doesn't define the process. And so what our view is, as testimony is taken, that what we need from the farmers when they come in and they outline what their objections are, we need them to flush it out enough that we know how to respond. So the way the process works is in an application, mining application, we look at around the site and we look at all the farm practices that are in effect, and we try to apply them to the apply the standard to them. Usually, other stuff we're not clairvoyant. We don't see everything that might come out of aggregate operation, and the so testimony is taken during the planning and the commission phases that. From the farmers to outline some of their concerns around the mine site. What we're asking in this bill is that the farmers put out enough information that we can respond to it. We're trying to get rid of the assertions that happened and things that aren't based on enough information from our perspective that we can really respond to. And what's happening in the process, because there's so much process around aggregate mining, is that each one of those levels accumulate as we go through the process, and we end up with boxes. I mean, literally boxes of conflicts that we end up dealing with. And you're going to hear some examples from some of our folks about some of the conflicts we spend considerable amount of money on. So with that, what happens in practice is, let's just say this, there's an assertion made. We actually have to create the problem with the assertion in order to resolve it. And that's the burden on assertion. What we're asking in this bill is that the farmers that come in bring some level of objective evidence in. I'm going to give an example, if I might, to address a couple of things, and then I'm done. I reviewed a lot of the letters, and a lot of the letters talk about that we are very successful in our application process. And if you were sitting as the planning commission and somebody came in and said, we're 97% successful in our application, they didn't substantiate it with anything, you said that, you'd say, okay, I don't know what to do with that. But if they came in and they said you were successful and they provided you some data that said, you know, 97% success rate for agriculture or applications for aggregate operations, you would say, well, that's something to deal with. What happens in this process is it would then kick over to us, because you, as the planning commission, as an example, would say, hey, that's enough to work on. And we would then respond, well, since 1996 to 2011, there's only been 280 acres on high-value farmland that's been permitted. In fact, then we would also tell you that the list, literally the list of denials, is huge. And Hood River Sand and Gravel, Hellberg in Murrell County, Elliott in Umatilla County, Mosier Quarries in Hood River, Quick Quarry in Baker County, Smith Quarry in Multnomah, Molalla River 1 and Reserve 2 have been denied. Westside Rock's been denied. Delta Sand and Gravel, Eugene, and on it goes. The denials for PAPAs, which is the issue, is significant through the state, and it's becoming a real problem. So that gives you an example of literally how this process would work using some of the comments I saw in on the record.
Thanks, Thank Rich. You. Does it make sense for me to have Steve talk next and then let...
Either way is fine.
I think
me.
It would be. And colleagues, I'm exercising a silver lining authority today that I didn't expect when I ran for office. Steve and I are old colleagues and often on the opposite sides of land use cases, and I find myself having the ability to limit the amount of time that he speaks. Who knew? We got about 3 minutes for you, Steve.
Well said, Vice Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Steve Pfeiffer. I'm a land use attorney with Perkins Coie and have been for many years now. In another phase of my life, I also served on the Land Conservation and Development Commission and served as chair as a member of the commission sometime from the early 90s, I think, to 2002. As part of that role, I also chaired a subcommittee of the commission from 94 to 96 to rewrite the Goal 5 administrative rule, which implements statewide planning Goal 5. And that's the rule which under which aggregate mining, among many other things, occurs. It's a process and a substantive rule. Lays out both the process for review as well as the substance. That review, which is the first time it had been undertaken in a couple of decades by the commission, had a number of objectives. We were trying, by the way, aggregate's only 1/12 of that rule. There are 12 other natural resources governed by that rule. We had a number of objectives. We wanted to provide some clarity. We wanted to provide some predictability to all parties to those debates, not just one side or the other. And we wanted to provide some sense of real certainty and consistency throughout the state. So it's one of the few examples you'll have in either statute or rule where this body of regulation for review of a specific development activity, in this case aggregate mining largely, is uniformly applicable to every county in the state, notwithstanding their codes providing otherwise. We preempted local codes and made this applicable in all 36 counties. And generally, I'm sure the jury's out, it's worked fairly well. I'm only going to speak to one issue, and it's my recollection, such as it may be, of the extent to which in the bill there's what we call a safe harbor provision. And it's a provision that in this dash 2 before you would say that the overall thrust of the process we put in place is, as Rich points out, and you'll hear more about, was to minimize conflicts with a variety of other competing uses and values. Minimize conflicts is defined in the rule itself. To render conflicts, dust, air, noise, water, other conflicts, transportation, traffic, congestion, to a level they're no longer significant. And that includes a key provision that says, for purposes of those conflicts which are governed by state, federal, or other regulatory schemes, a demonstration of compliance with that other scheme or regulatory requirement is deemed to be compliance with the rule. That was the safe harbor. The question before us is whether this bill appropriately includes a safe harbor provision, as I believe the rule did. I will tell you, my understanding at the time was that we established five types of conflicts: D, conflicts with agricultural practices, being, just checking to make sure I'm correct there, being a key one. We intended all those conflicts, including agricultural practices embodied in the statute, 215-296, to be subject to the safe harbor. I understand that may be a question of whether the intent of the rule was to do that. That's my understanding. I'll leave you with one other thought. At the time, we believed that was a good policy. I think the safe harbor served us well. It avoids redundancy in regulation. It provides certainty to the extent there's a parallel regulatory scheme elsewhere. And the issue before you, I would argue today, is probably less what the rule and those of us who helped draft it back in the day intended, and more whether a safe harbor is warranted to, again, provide certainty to all and avoid the redundancy and the subjectivity of not having that in the conflict, actually, of not having a safe harbor and allow requirements to be applied differently under different regulatory schemes for the same type of conflict or impact. I think it's a good idea. I support the provision in the bill, regardless of whether you conclude that we got it right back in the day in 96 or not. Thank you.
Marianne.
Vice Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash. I am the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau, here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2666. And for the record, I don't think there are any amendments posted on OLIS yet, but I did see some of the earlier amendments, so you'll notice that my testimony speaks to an alleged dash one that I realize is not actually live yet. However, the majority of the provisions are really similar to the existing bill, so I'm happy to speak to both. We view House Bill 2666 as a solution in search of a problem. And I don't think it's before you yet, but one of my members is going to present some data that we received from DLCD that shows that there's been a 97% success rate for aggregate projects within farm use zones. Only 11 projects out of the 358 tracked by DLCD have been denied the right to mine for aggregate resources within land zone for EFU. And a lot of the complaints that we're hearing through this work group relate to processes that are already available for local governments to streamline their permit processes. Some counties may choose to do it differently. We've left that to a county-by-county determination within our land use system. So a lot of the fixes that I think are being sought here are things that are maybe complaints of how the counties are applying the existing law, or even some confusion among counties about what some of the existing evidentiary standards are now. The existing state of the law right now is that farmers who claim that there is an impact to their operations do have to come forward with evidence if they want that evidence considered on the record and they want it to be part of the land use decision. It has to be more than just a bald assertion. There is an existing evidentiary standard here that does apply. However, I don't think it is as high of a standard as maybe some of the aggregate operators would like it to be. Our farmers are hardworking people. They don't normally hire attorneys and experts. And so often their evidence is, hey, I'm concerned that this is going to happen. This, you know, dust impact is going to limit my ability to sell my crops. It's going to impact the cost of my operations or impact my farming practices. Increased traffic is going to impact my ability to safely get from one field to another to safely traverse and maintain my agricultural operations. Those are real world impacts, and those are impacts that should be considered when looking at siting aggregate projects within EFU zones. And under my view of the amendments, the original bill and the amendments, the burden would be shifted to the farmer to raise those issues. And since I don't have very much time left, I'm going to touch quickly on the safe harbor provision as well. The state permit standards look at impacts to public resources. They don't look at the specific analysis that the state's required to undertake under 215-296. And in speaking with our counsel, who was aware when these rules were adopted, his understanding was that the 215-296 compatibility analysis was always separate from and kind of a step above the Goal 5 rule process. The Goal 5 rule process is more of a siting process, whereas the 215-296 is about real-world impacts for that specific project on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much, panel.
Thanks.
So at this time, I'd like to invite up Mark. I know I got some other folks teed up, but Mark Reed. Is Mark in the room or outside?
Yes.
Come on up. You seem to be the person that's from the farthest away. Sarah, is Sarah here? Come on up, Sarah. And then David. And so for folks that are here for the remaining three bills up for public hearing, at 2:30, Representative Greg Smith should be back in the room. We're going to hold the hearing on HJM 15 at that time. There's five people signed up to testify. I want to get those folks heard. Then we'll move on to HB 3213, and then followed by HB 2983. And both of those lists are fairly short. And then I will return to the farmers that are here to talk about 2666, and we'll hear you until about 3 o'clock or until Representative Gilliam has to go on to other things. Go right ahead, whoever wants to start.
Sure. My name is Mark Reed. I'm a professor of geology at the University of Oregon, and I have studied the issue of sand and gravel and aggregate resources generally in Western Oregon for the past 15 years. I speak here on my own behalf, not as a representative of the University of Oregon. I'll first point out that I submitted written testimony that is far more complete than what I'm going to present now. I'm going to hit two main points at this juncture. So please refer to the written testimony for many of the details. But I'd like to stress that although aggregate production is essential for, certainly it's essential for building bridges and roads and buildings and whatnot, that aggregate can come from either of two common sources available in Western Oregon. Those two sources are sand and gravel that come out of the valley bottom, which is mined from soil from beneath soils that are the very best we have, classes 1 and 2. The other big source is quarry rock, that is rock that's mined out of basalt quarries up and down the Willamette Valley. And so my written testimony will show that roughly half of the production of aggregate in Oregon comes from each of those two sources. And to illustrate my point, I see that I have 30 seconds. I refer you to one of the handouts I just gave you, a map. This is also from the written report, showing with the black squares the distribution of rock quarries in the valley, and the brown rock that's shown on there, all the color in brown, is the distribution of basalt that is being mined for a quarry resource for aggregate. And that the point is that there's a tremendous supply of aggregate from quarries, and we do not need to destroy the best farm soils to get that aggregate. And my second main point, which will be very brief, is that from a study by economist Dr. Ed Whitelaw from around the year 2000, there's two of these that are quoted specifically and written in my written testimony, stating that the employment actually goes down when we mine river rock from the valley bottom. When it goes down, in effect, because the farmland that is destroyed causes a loss of jobs, but there is no loss of jobs if we don't mine that gravel. Instead, we can mine the rock in the hills, which will reproduce the same jobs. So that is a quotation. I mean, that's not a quote. That is from a study by Ed Whitelaw, who has made that very clear in his testimony that is attached to my written material. So,
thank you.
The employment argument doesn't hold, and certainly we have another alternative. Thank you.
Thank you. Right ahead.
Vice Chair Helm, committee. My name is Sarah Däumling. I'm a farm and forest landowner in Polk County, raised in the Willamette Valley on a farm, been in Oregon for a long time. It's the place, there's nowhere I'd rather live. I'm speaking as a citizen and as a member of Friends of Polk County, both. I think more and more people are thinking that they'd like to live in Oregon. I met my first climate refugee a couple of weeks ago, and I'm afraid there will be many more as California runs out of water and fracking and drought ruin farmland and make life less attractive in other parts of the country. Oregon's land use laws have done a reasonably good job of protecting our farmland over the last decades, but there are always new cracks and loopholes in these laws, and HB 266 would be one more big one. There will be no more fine farmland. What we have now is what we have, regardless of how many people come to Oregon or how many inhabit the earth. Every acre we convert to gravel pits is gone forever. The food products we can grow on this land can and will feed Oregonians, and any that is left over will always be infinitely exportable, permanently good for both economy and jobs. And that land will not quit producing as farmland. It won't ruin the land like a rock pit. Protecting our farmland, all of it, but especially the good river bottom land, is the absolute best investment we can make in Oregon's future. HB 266 is a bad idea, and I urge you to reject it.
Thank you. Right ahead.
Good afternoon, Vice Chairs and members of the committee. My name is David Engen. I'm a retired Navy officer and Merchant Marine officer. I've seen a lot of this world. And whenever I returned to Oregon, I always felt a tremendous amount of relief because I could see what was going on in many of the other places. Rather interestingly, I just passed a letter written by Professor Reed's wife that was in the Eugene paper. I just passed that out to you and make some excellent points. And I won't take too much of your time. I'm just going to quote a few things here. This is New York Times, November 3rd, 2014. UN panel issues its starkest warning yet on global warming. Without immediate action, flooding, food shortages, and mass extinctions likely. Here's a National Geographic, and the date was October 2014, drought in the West, mapping California's water. As you all know, California has been in a severe drought for the last 4 years. This is Le Monde Diplomatique, and it has an article about a severe water shortage that is now taking place in Brazil. And I'm afraid this is the future for all of us, and if we destroy our farmland, it's going to come a lot quicker. I own a little bit of farmland here in the state, but I don't farm it. Somebody else does. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, folks, for coming today. At this point, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on HB 2666. We'll get back to it as soon as we can. And open a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 15. And ask Representative Smith to come on forward. You're very punctual, sir. Let me give a quick preface for this joint memorial. This is not a new idea, the idea of someday being able to view Celilo Falls as it naturally flowed in the past. It was an idea talked about in the mid-80s, and then again in the mid-2000s for the bicentennial of the Lewis and Clark tour of discovery. And I'm very happy that folks are here to talk about it today to give us their perspectives. And I just want to note that as written, it's a preliminary baby step to ask the Corps of Engineers if it is indeed possible to operate the Dalles Dam to accomplish that and no more. Just the beginning place for such a conversation into the future. And Representative Smith was kind enough to share his opinion immediately upon hearing, and I appreciate that, and I welcome you here today.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes the great community of Milton Freewater and Hermiston and Stanfield and Umatilla, Port of Umatilla, Port of Morrow in Morrow County, Port of Arlington in Gillam County, Sherman County, and also the Dalles Dam as we head into Duffer in Wasco County. I've had an opportunity to read House Joint Memorial 15, and I can appreciate the sentiment of why we're introducing this. There's some thoughts that I want to share for the record on this. I've been involved in conversations on the Columbia Snake River system for over 25 years now. And it's important to understand that the Columbia Snake River system is just that. It's a system. It's made up of locks all the way from Idaho down to Bonneville Dam on the Columbia River. And it's very important that these locks and these dams work together in partnership. And should you interrupt the service on one of those dams, it could have dramatic effects on the rest of the system. Let me share with you how that might play out. First and foremost is the reason these dams were originally put into place, and that was for flood control. Multnomah County is very dependent upon those locks and those dams operating at full functionality. And so it would concern me if we in any way undermine that specific purpose. And I would keep in mind that the Port of Portland, in its location and proximity to the Columbia River, could potentially be most devastated by a lowering of Lake Celilo. The second thing I'd like to share with the committee is understand that there are waterfowl and wildlife that depend upon Lake Celilo, particularly migratory waterfowl, ducks and geese. And many of those geese are protected and endangered species. And so once again, we've got to be very, very careful with our good intentions to not in any way undermine those sensitive species. So we've got flood control as a potential issue. We've got to make sure that we're protecting our wildlife. The second thing I want to remind the committee is that navigation is an important factor of the Columbia Snake River system. And we have barges that come all the way from Lewiston and Clarkston that are carrying our farmers' products, wheat, commodities such as corn, beans, all of those type of products up and down the Columbia Snake River system. And we want to be careful that we're not, once again, interrupting the locks that our industries are dependent upon. I want to remind you that a secondary reason, and this was a secondary reason those dams were put in place, was to ensure that we had affordable and reliable power. And the Dalles Dam is part of that, of the Pacific Northwest power grid in creating that affordable power. Now, why is that important? Why is that important? Well, during the interim, I had an opportunity to talk with a Fortune 500 high-tech company who was looking at coming into my industry. And it was really fascinating to visit with them when they talked about that hydro in their mind, in their corporate culture, is renewable. And I would hate for us in any way to undermine that renewable, low-cost, affordable power that all of us in the Pacific Northwest enjoy. I also want to talk with you about the concern of losing irrigation opportunities. By lowering the pool at Lake Celilo, we would be impacting upriver irrigation opportunities. Folks who are using that water, and by the way, I want to share this with you just very quickly. The amount of water that comes out of the Columbia is minute compared to what is lost to evaporation. But nonetheless, those pumps are placed in a stationary location, and should the pool be lowered, they would have to accommodate that lowering. So I want to share with you that would be a potential issue. And the last thing I want to visit with you about is the recreational opportunities. We've got many folks who use Celilo Lake for recreational activities that benefit the economy of Wasco County and Sherman County and Gillam County and even Morrow County. And so I would hope that you would take into consideration that should House Joint Memorial pass, we're sending a message to those local counties that their tourism activities perhaps are not as important. And I don't think that's what we want to do. Finally, committee, I want to share what perhaps is more of an emotional argument than an intellectual argument. I've been involved in this discussion, as I shared with you, for many years, several decades. Sometimes it's better not to pick fights. And right now, we've got our four treaty tribes and the Yakima and the Warm Springs and the Nez Perce and the Umatilla working together with industry on the Columbia River. We may not always agree, and there might be projects that we're not able to get taken care of, but for the most part, we're all working together. By lowering the Celilo Lake, we're going to start an argument that just doesn't need to be started. Finally, colleagues, I want to share this with you, and this is awkward to share, but it's a reality. Celilo Falls does not look like it once did. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending upon your perspective, when the John Day Dam was created, significant modification to those falls occurred. And so should we lower the Dalles Dam, and should we see what's behind that dam, it's not going to look the way it once did. And that's just a reality. So, colleagues, I understand House Joint Memorial 15 was introduced for some good reasons. Folks wanted to be able to bring back a portion of their history. They wanted to look at perhaps some alternative employment and economic development opportunities. But the reality is those opportunities just don't exist. And so, colleagues, I would ask that you not support House Joint Memorial 15. Mr. Vice Chair, I really, really appreciate you giving me this opportunity to introduce this, and I definitely introduce you and I visiting on this issue. That's what working in a bipartisan manner is all about. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to share these thoughts with you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Representative.
Have a great day.
Okay. At this time, I'll invite Sean Cruz and Cynthia Vogel. And how about Tabitha Whitefoot? Come on up. And again, folks, we have very little time, about 2 minutes, if you can.
Really? Thank you.
I've got two other bills to get through. I'm sorry.
Yes, okay. Thank you, Chair Hill, members of the committee. My name is Sean Aaron Cruz. I'm representing the Friends of Celilo Falls. And I really wanted to defer to, there are people here from Celilo Village that have come a long ways today, and they've waited a long time to have their opportunity to speak. And actually, the last time that any person had an opportunity to speak about Celilo was in the 2007 legislative session. So if it was all due respect and your permission, could we do that?
Is it Lana or Laura? Jack? Come on up, yeah. And anybody else that's from Celilo Village, come on up, yeah. I try to get folks that are from a ways away to get up here first, so happy to have you. Go right ahead.
My name is Lana Jack. That's my English name. I come from a long line of maternal ancestors from Celilo who have fought and lost this battle The redevelopment of Celilo at this point is our sixth relocation plan, completely disenfranchising the YM people. Today, as the granddaughter of Minnie Wesley Shaway, the great-granddaughter of Minnie Wesley Shaway, and the granddaughter of Irene Williams Bruno, in 1957, these women stood against the United States government to tell their stories and make their pleas for their people. In 1957, it was disregarded because it was more important to have electricity to send to California. It was more important to have barges running to Clarkston and Lewiston. It was more important to serve the greater need of a community, meanwhile oppressing. No. Committing genocide upon a people. Celilo Falls, uncovering it. Do you ask, am I in favor? I don't know. All I know is that our people have suffered long, too long behind all of this. And it's time for reconciliation. It's time for recompense. It's time for restoration. It's time for a people who've been there 10,000 years to be recognized. So if there was an appeal that I was to make to any one of you, it'd be on behalf of a people who have been terminated and exterminated and thrown to the winds.
Thank you for your testimony. Go right ahead.
Hello. I already have submitted a written testimony, but I guess there's
only... Can we get your name on
the record?
Tabitha
Whitefoot.
Thank you.
I hear what Lana is saying, and I actually support her very much because this is a very troubled issue. I've traveled up past Lewiston and up onto the Nez Perce Reservation, and up there the hills are blue with our roots and everything because they're still growing. And they're growing there because of the mist. All of the, you know, I know that other animals have filled in Celilo Lake, but the reality is for 10 to 14 days, it's not going to bring back our ecosystem. It's not going to bring back something that's going to be recognizable to those of us who were there, because I did go through inundation. I was in Celilo Village the day of inundation, and there are less and less of us that can say that. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that I don't know why we want to expose the bones, maybe even the destroyed bones of our falls. I don't see the use of it. I don't see the, you know, how is this going to benefit anybody? I'm sorry they want to see the falls. I didn't get to see them because I was legally blind when I was a child. But I know how they sounded. I know how it smelled. I know how it felt. And you're not going to get that back. I mean, look at what happened with Condit Dam. It was completely, when they let it down, it was full of mud. Everything had to wash out. We're not going to see my hometown, Spearfish, we're not going to see it in its beauty or have our roots or have anything back the way it was. It's just going to be mud. And I don't know why people would want to do this. I have no idea.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm Linda George Mianis. I'm the great-granddaughter of Chief Tommy Thompson. And I was 6 years old when I seen the inundation of... excuse me, of Celilo. This is kind of a sad day for the village that they feel like, why you want to do this? It's just like doing another inundation of our ancestors, of our family, of a way of life that's already been destroyed. And we want to keep it going with our future generations because my grandkids, they love the fishing. They love the salmon. They love the roots and the berries, and they love the way of life that they have right now before it's destroyed again. And every year we have millions of people, that not millions, but thousands of people come to the village, because we always have. Last weekend we had our salmon feast, and it was an honor of our first foods that is always provided to us. And we feel like, don't destroy something that we have to live through again. I mean, just think if it was your family living there, what would you do? How would you feel if it was you in our place? I think you would feel the same way. Taking something away from them again is just going to be a heartbreak to my future generation, to my grandkids. And I feel like, you know, we don't need to have another inundation for our future generation. We've already been suffered through this once. We don't need to do it again. You know, and it was for the name of progress. Think of another way. You know, it's not about money, it's about a way of life. It's about traditions and culture. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming today and sharing your perspectives. Appreciate it. At this time, thank you. At this time, I think we may have two more people. Cynthia Vogel. And Treyeth? Yeah. Again, I'm sorry that we're running so late. I could encourage you again to be brief. I would appreciate it.
Certainly. Chair Helm and members of the committee, for the record, Sean Aaron Cruz, and I want to give a little bit different perspective. I was Senator Avil Gordley's chief of staff in the 07 session of the 50-year anniversary of the flooding of Salila Falls, and delegations of the Umatilla and Warm Springs tribes and the people of Salila Village, including two of the speakers today, came to the Capitol, asked Senator Gordley to sponsor the two Salila bills. And I just want to quote one line from the resolution that, where is it? That, no, that's not it. It's in the other page. That's part of the resolution that was read in the Senate floor by Senator Gordley. It says, whereas on March 10th, 1957, the waters held back by the Dalles Dam flooded and silenced the awesome and sacred roar of Salila Falls, severing a great spiritual connection between the Creator, Mother Earth, and the Native peoples of Oregon. And you see an evidence, you've heard evidence, that that is the case, and that is the case that will live forever in a lot of people's hearts. And I also heard when the bills came to the Senate floor, the discussion among the senators was that to flood Salila Falls today would be unthinkable. That if the falls were flooded, were there, if the tribal fishery existed today, who would propose flooding it, and particularly for barging? Now, it turns out that the Army Corps of Engineers did a sonar study some years ago and determined that not only the rock structure of the falls are intact, but it's not silted up. There's still a pulse there. It's not silted up. We have that report from the Corps of Engineers. And so the thing is, when the tribes came to the Capitol in 07 and discussed this, they told us that the falls were not flooded for hydropower, but for two other reasons. Barging, navigation, and to force the Indians to abandon the village, which was consistent with federal policy in the 50s of the termination and relocation era.
Sean, if and, I could ask you to wrap up.
So the thing is, the end result, what I hope we get, is that the legislative body will appoint an interim task force to study the issue of the Columbia River Treaty Review and the proposal to add ecosystem-based function as a third fundamental purpose of the treaty, and bring that study to the 2016 Legislative Assembly. That's what we're hoping you'll do. Thank you.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Good day. I'm Treyeth Joseph Bullock. I'm a board member of the Friends of Salila Falls, and I'm also a board member of the Salila Falls Education Fund. I'm speaking for the Education Fund today. We've brought some photographs, historic photographs of the falls. And our organization is a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to advocating for the natural rights of the Columbia River itself. And key points in our vision are the revitalization of her waters, which have borne toxic loads for quite a while, recovery of the native fisheries, and full restoration of indigenous harvest sites on the Mid-Columbia. It's our perspective that the flooding of Celilo Falls in 1957 is not a historic event, but that it's an ongoing genocidal violence. We believe that the river itself deserves to be a living river rather than an impounded industrial highway. And we see some of the factors that are coming toward us in climate change, which are going to require the river to actually have higher flow rates in order to counter the warming of the river. And that's going to impede the efficiency of barge traffic. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, barge traffic was shut down for 6 months. Alternative methods were used for transport at very small differences in cost. The barges are subsidized by public monies, and we don't think that's a sustainable system. One of the other things you may not know is that dams are not, in fact, green. The decomposition of matter behind the dams is contributing methane gas, a greenhouse warming gas, at the same level as the world's transportation systems right now. So if we're going to make meaningful action in response to anthropogenic factors in climate change, dam removal eventually is going to need to be part of that picture. So we're recommending that you go forward with a task force to actually explore the options, explore these questions, to make a recommendation in the 2014-2024 process, to really look at the ecological services of the river as well as the cultural services of the river that are connected to its indigenous histories and presence. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, were you?
Yeah.
You're up here as audio vision. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks everybody for coming today. I have to move on to the next hearing. I'm sorry.
Can I just say I agree with the task force?
Thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I've written that down.
Okay.
So we'll see what we can do. Again, thanks for coming and sharing your perspectives on this idea. I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 15, and I'm going to carry over at this time the public hearing and possible work session for HB 3213. We'll take that up next Tuesday. Also, I'm going to have to carry over the work session for House Bill 3282. The amendment's here, but the fiscal's not. So we'll do that on Tuesday as well. At this time, I'm going to open the public hearing on HB 2983 and ask Warren Weathers. Warren's still here. Come on up. Thanks for being patient. This is a easy to understand, simple idea that I think we'll all get. And if Christopher, Noah, and George, do you want to come up real quick? Okay. Our committee administrator is going to read the proposal real quick, and then we'll get your comments.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 2983, as amended in the Dash 3 amendment, would permit organizers of fishing derby to acquire fishing derby licenses from the State Fish and Wildlife Commission free of charge to take northern pike minnow and to sell fish during the duration of the derby. And it would also eliminate a requirement of individuals to possess fishing derby licenses if organizer holds permit.
Right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do I need to reduce this? I had it written for 6 minutes. And
please, I think you can reduce it. It's a great idea, and I think we've all seen a little bit of it already. So please identify yourself for the record first.
Mr. Chairman and honorable committee members and staff, I'm Warren Weathers, and I live in Lowell, and I'm here representing the Blackberry Jam Fishing Derby. The derby is part of an annual Blackberry Jam Festival. It's self-supporting, and this will be our 22nd year. Last year, we learned that state law requires fish brokers and commercial fishermen and owners of commercial boats that have commercial licenses, which vary in cost from $200 to $700 each, with many variations depending, I think, on what the people did. It appears that the law applies to anyone who intends to catch a fish with the intention of selling it or accepting a prize associated with catching it. We understand that these requirements are dictated by Oregon statutes, so there is no opportunity to modify regulations to correct unintended consequences of previous legislation. Since the problem was identified in 2013, our numbers of entrants have dropped by 50%, many of whom were worried about the possibility of violating an unfamiliar law. If adopted, House Bill 2983-3 will allow pike minnow derbies to be held without requiring sport fishing contestants to purchase a commercial fishing license. The proposed legislation also provides that the derby organization is required to apply for a derby license from ODFW at no cost. The licensed derby organization would be allowed to sell pike minnow carcasses as crab bait or soil amendment while the derby is in session. If House Bill 2983-3 does not pass, our derby will end, as neither the derby nor our contestants can afford the commercial licenses. Without this legislation, the pike minnow population will likely expand to pre-1993 conditions, which is when we began the derby, and will replace the bass and trout in Dexter Lake, thus disenfranchising sport anglers visiting our community and causing them to find some other place to fish and to patronize their businesses at their new fishing hole.
Warren, if I could ask you to wrap up.
We believe the corrective adjustments prescribed in the bill solve the problem and are reasonable and fair, and we ask you to adopt House Bill 2983. And I'd like to introduce Chris Chapman and Noah Rose, our students.
Very good. If you'd just identify yourself for the record.
I'm Christopher Chapman of Lowell Junior Senior High School. I am a junior there. I participate in band, choir, football, track, and also know several students on all the other sports teams. We are very successful at what we do, mostly because of fundraising, particularly this derby. It produces a lot of money for our sports teams. With it, it enables us to produce high-quality athletics and extracurricular activities. I would also like to mention at this point that our extracurricular activities, band, choir, football, volleyball, wrestling, and track, along with many others, have made at least state playoff levels and beyond. We have very high quality athletics at the 1A division,
yeah.
And that's primarily due to this fundraising that we are able to do with the Fish Derby, and I would ask that we can continue to do that and produce high quality extracurricular activities.
Good. Thank you.
Great. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If I could just interrupt, I apologize. I know a lot of members have got other hearings or work sessions at 3 o'clock, and it's unfortunate we don't get a chance to hear everybody that's here to testify, but I'm going to have to excuse myself.
Very good. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hellman, Committee. I'm also a student at Lowell Junior Senior High School, and I've been a resident at Lowell for 17 years, and I'm going to summarize all of the good things that the Fishing Derby has done for our community.
I missed your name, if you could just give
it. Noah Rose.
Thanks, Noah.
All right, thank you. So the Fishing Derby has provided economic, social, and financial bonuses for the whole community. Financially, it supports our school with all the income from the Derby. Socially, people gather to these events and share fishing tales, meet up, just have a good time in general. And environmentally, we're taking out invasive species, which helps out the lake a lot, and will also in turn help out the trout population and provide a good chance for anglers. So I think this is a great opportunity for our community and should definitely be considered as a valuable option. Thank you.
Thank you all. Any questions for our panel? No. Thank you all very much. Your public hearing is complete, so you're in the hopper now. Do we have George?
I'll forego. They said more than I could say.
Great. Thank you very much. That helps our schedule. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2983 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2666. We already did that, right? I know that there's a bunch of folks that are in the building every day left, so we'll try here in the next few minutes to get through folks from further away. And I've got Roger, Kathleen, Carl. Okay. Eileen. And then Sam Sweeney. Sam. Go right ahead. And again, if you can be as brief as possible, that helps us get to our next place.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Helm and the rest of the committee. For the record, my name is Roger Kay. I'm current president of Friends of Marion County. And our organization and its individual members are opposed to House Bill 2666 and request a no vote. I think I submitted testimony, and I think it's being handed to you at this moment. Friends of Marion County is a 501c3 farmland protection organization founded in 1998. Our mission is to protect farm and forest lands, parks, and open space. There are several reasons we oppose this bill, and we'll list just a few. First of all, the mining industry claims that only approximately 1% of Willamette Valley farmland has been used for aggregate mining. The Willamette Valley extends from Portland to Eugene, about 150 miles long and 30 miles wide. Please don't be fooled that this is a mere trifle. This amounts to approximately 14,000 acres, or approximately one-half the size of the city of Salem. This is a huge amount of farmland consumed, which can never be remediated to agricultural use. House Bill 2666 prevents affected citizens from rendering testimony unless they own properties surrounding the proposed mine. No longer can citizens voice concerns about transportation to and from the mine that would adversely affect their own farming operations. Remember, mines generate a great deal of year-round heavy truck traffic. This bill would take the land out of the base of Oregon's number two industry, agriculture. Three, HB 2666 essentially stipulates that surrounding farm property owners must show that they are unable to undertake any farm practice. Thus, farm property owners may find the investment in their current practice may be lost. HB 2666 takes irreplaceable farmland out of production. With the ongoing drought conditions, we need to preserve every acre of farmland possible. HB 266 is ill-conceived and a real threat to Oregon's landscape. We therefore request a no vote on this measure. Furthermore, if Mr. Spock were here, he would say this bill is illogical. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you.
So tell Mr. Post.
Yes, he's our trekker here. Eileen?
My name is Eileen Kay, Vice Chair Helm and members of the committee. I live in South Marion County because I have three horses. I've been through three aggregate permits. Of course, we lost all of them. And I did pass out the sheet we got from DLCD that shows, I don't know what Angstrom was talking about, frankly, because very, very few are denied of the aggregate permits. There was also an aggregate overlay zone proposed by Marion County that we fought. The only reason that that didn't happen is that there was a school in the middle of the aggregate overlay zone. And I know I'm not allowed to ask a question, but I, from what I see of this and any amendment, is that what this says is that nobody now can protest or has standing unless you're right next, directly next, and that you're a farmer. So that if this overlay zone was proposed again, even though there's a grade school, it looks like the parents and the people who live in the area would have absolutely no standing and nowhere to go with their concerns. I think that this bill was born out of a fool's bargain. HB 2202 that was passed in 2013 was nothing. It did nothing. The rules were never even written, so it was never implemented. What this bargain does is gives citizens a cookie and gives OCAPA the whole store. Please vote no.
Thank you. Sam?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Sam Sweeney. I live at 1070 Ferry Street, Dayton, Oregon. I strongly urge you to reject House Bill 266. The bill, if adopted, even with the amendments, would make it even easier to convert some of our best and most precious farm areas to mineral extraction.
Sam, can I get you to push that microphone away from you a little bit? Just push it back.
This way?
Away from you.
Oh, okay.
They're very sensitive.
Okay.
That's much better. Thank
you. All right. Sorry about that. Our family farms in Yamhill County and have closely watched the loss of the county's best farmland under the present inadequate conversion regulations. Since 2001, there have been three applications to mine in the county's Willamette River bottoms. All three were opposed and fought vigorously by numerous concerned citizens who hired attorneys, expert witnesses, and spent a lot of money in the process. However, all three were eventually approved. The result, the loss of over 800 acres of prime flood-enriched farmland. Grand Island, an island of the best soils with old seniority, full season irrigation rights, low head pumping costs, close proximity to markets, and capable, knowledge and innovative farmers will be severely impacted. Grand Island is a poster child of an area that should never be touched by a mining company's track hole, but it lost 650 acres, or 16% of its farmable land, in less than 10 years under the current unfair regulations. It is a prime example of why the current regulations are not working to protect the best of Oregon's agricultural areas. The conversion regulations definitely need to be changed, but to ones that would reflect Oregon citizens' values and their desire to protect the state's prime but very limited Willamette Valley floodplain soils. House Bill 266 is just the opposite of what Oregon needs. It needs to be soundly rejected. Thank you very much.
Thanks, folks. Appreciate it. So here's some folks that aren't going to get to testify today. Steve McCoy, Mark Nystrom, Peggy Lynch. You guys can find me later. who we've got next is Fran Taylor. Fran, are you still here? Come on up. Laura Freeman Swanson. Laura? Carla Mickelson. And then Neil. Neil, come on up, and you can tell me how to say your last name. Oh, we got four, so hold on, Neil. Go right ahead. Go ahead, Fran.
Okay, good afternoon, and thank you, Chairman, or Vice Chair Helm, and remaining committee members. I am Fran Taylor, and I am Secretary of the Malala Community Planning Organization, and I've been authorized by the CPO to give this testimony. The Malala Community Planning Organization, or CPO, opposes House Bill 2666 and urges that it not be passed out of committee. This bill would allow special standards for agrimint mining for determining if they conflict with agricultural practices and undo 40-plus years of land use. To kind of follow on Ms. Nash's thought, this bill would place the burden of proof on the farmers that you represent.
which I find, and our CPO finds, to be a concern. And on top of that, when these issues go to county planning hearings, to LUBA and Land Use Board of Appeals, they go with lots and lots and lots of statistics and information. So there's lots of information presented. The Malala CPO has been designated by the state and Clackamas County to represent citizens in matters of land use. The CPO has consistently taken positions against the mining, crushing, and stockpiling of aggregate in EFU type 1 and 2 soils, special soil lands, and along the Malala River. Granting of mining applications on type 1 and 2 and special soils condemns farmland to extinction. After digging a 60-foot hole encompassing a 100-acre field and extracting gravels, it will no longer be able to return to farmland. What remains is a 100-acre lake 60 feet deep. With the loss of land also goes loss of jobs, never to return.
Fran, can I ask you to wrap up, please?
Okay, right now we see a decrease in type 1 and 2 farmlands. We also are concerned about wet mining, which brings down the water levels and can contaminate irrigation ditches, wells, aquifers, and waterways. As with much of Willamette Valley, there has been a significant increase in economy, and small farms are contributing greatly to the economy and jobs.
And
again, we strongly
please.
Urge that you do not move this bill out of committee.
Thank you. Okay, go right ahead.
My name is Carla Michelson. For your staff person, it's M-I-K-K-E-L-S-O-N, because I don't have written things to give her.
Okay.
First, I was here partly because the Marion County Democrats asked me to read a letter into the record, but it seems to me that everything they wanted read has already been said. I just want that the Marion County Democratic Central Committee Legislative Subcommittee is very opposed to this bill, and I'll just to have that in the record. I would also like to testify briefly as a citizen. I'll try to do it fast. If Representative Clem were here, he'd tell you that's hard for me to do. I have nothing against the aggregate mining industry. I have gravel driveways, gravel parking lots for our farm equipment. I recently used it to set up my solar array. So I don't really have a problem there. What I have a problem with this bill is, at least I have not seen Amendment 3. But to me, the problem with this bill is it's taking away the ability of citizens to participate in a process that is extremely important to them. It gives more weight to what's going on in the aggregate mining industry than it does in the agricultural industry. And I really have a hard time with the idea that the burden of proof gets moved to the farmer. The farmer was there first. The burden of proof should be on the mining companies to prove that this is the only place that they can actually have their facilities. And the reason you don't have more farmers here today is it's a sunny day in April. They're working. So I would really, I don't know if that Amendment 3 is going to address any of my concerns, having not seen it. But as it stands right now and what I have seen, I would urge the committee to vote no on this bill.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Lori Freeman Swanson. I reside at 14706 South Maxburg Road in Malala, Oregon. I have a 250-acre farm raising cattle, horses, hay, doing horse show productions. I lease property and I lease hay storage facility. I agree with all the arguments that the Farm Bureau is offering and also other people that are testifying here. I would like to give you a little picture of some farmland that made it through, that's how I view it, a mining application. Farmlands previously faced with gravel applications continue to thrive and have become stronger after denial. And why not? After all, we are talking about type 1 and type 2 soils. In our area, if applications have been approved, we would be minus over 350 acres of farmland, possibly more if the river had failed from the poor mine design and inundating neighboring farms. The surrounding berry farms are thriving because there have been they have not been put in jeopardy. Two major chicken farms are able to continue with their grows without threat of loss of water and stress to noise and dust pollution. Large herds of cattle graze on tended rich fields where there would have been no fields. Grow crops, including beans and pumpkins, thrive. And irrigation, this is important. And irrigation company distributes water that tends to use farmland, that tends to these farmlands without risk of pollution. Wells supply water without risk of dewatering or pollution.
Or if I could ask you to wrap up, please.
I'm going to finish up here in just a second. Shipping to market situations continues to be more complicated. Our local farm markets are rising to the top on the list of importance. Not only is fresh, healthy, and safe important, but costs say it is getting to be the best way to distribute food. Something I would like to throw out there, since this whole thing seems to be discussed for discussion at the moment, I would like to see how part of the application process be an accurate measure of raw product available versus product need. In our area, that study was done and was reflected in the outcome of some permitting decisions. Having 3 to 5 times more than the necessary amount of land approved for mining, with the end result of totally destroying that amount of valuable land forever, does not make sense.
Thank you.
I could say a whole lot more. I will say nicely that we have all come, and you know, I'm glad you're here, but I would have appreciated to have a real hearing, you know, with the other members here. Maybe another day.
Well, we're now 15 minutes past the time that the hearing's supposed to end, so.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
And I just want to say I hope you feel better soon.
I'm getting there. Thank you. Next up is Bob Short and Randall Helchick. And Jerome Rosa. And then after that, I've got Jason Brown and Laura Masterson, and that's it. Oh, come up. Come on up, Neil. Yep. Oh, you're still here, Bruce. Okay. We thought you're gone. Okay. Go right ahead.
Chairman Helm, Representative Gilliam, I'm Randy Lettick here on behalf of Wildish Sand and Gravel Company in support of House Bill 2666. Wildish is a family-owned company that's been supplying Lane County with aggregate products for over 80 years. Our 348-acre mining site straddles the McKenzie River between Eugene and Coburg. The time has come for us to consider expanding the pit by 45 acres. As we move forward with our extension request, we will need to hire land use planning consultants, engineers, geologists, biologists, botanists, and archaeologists to prepare fact-based studies that address groundwater, floodplain issues, wetlands, wildlife habitat, traffic, noise, dust, and cultural resources. Based on our past experiences, we anticipate these studies will cost $10,000 to $15,000 each. And then there will be attorney fees as we make our way through the various local, state, and federal permitting processes. The problem with ORS 215.296 in its current form is that there is no clear and objective standard of evidence required of opponents to a mining application to show that surface mining does in fact force a significant change in farm or forest practices or significantly increase the cost. As a result, mine operators often respond to a host of unsubstantiated conjecture and allegations offered by those opposing the mining activity. For example, noise will adversely affect the reproductive capability of goats, sheep, horses, and cows. Soil disturbance will lead to arsenic poisoning in well water. Coyotes will be displaced, putting pheasants on adjacent land in peril. Cows will refuse to eat pasture grass that has mining dust on it, and loss of farmland to mining will tip a farming community over the edge because critical mass will be diminished. It is expensive and time-consuming to respond to claims that do not demonstrate significant change or loss based upon objective evidence. House Bill 2666 is all about placing fairness in the process. We ask for your support.
Thank you. My name is Bob Short. I'm currently retired. I am a former public affairs manager of Cal Portland Company, which is a sand, gravel, cement, and concrete company operating largely in the Portland metro area. We have gravel facilities in Columbia County. And just I want to make one statement here real quick. According to data provided by the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, there are 2,800,000 acres of high-value farmland in the Willamette Valley. Of those, 2,494 are permitted for mining. That's 0.1%. But anyway, what I want to do is I want to tell you a story that illustrates the kind of testimony that mining companies have to deal with and why we're looking for a higher evidentiary standard of people bringing claims that of damage caused prospectively by aggregate mines. In Columbia County, I want to talk about three mining applications. The first occurred in the early 1990s and was actually withdrawn for other reasons. But as a result of that, we had a hydrologist come in and study the hydrology of the entire area surrounding this, the Scappoose Drainage District, which is behind a dike on the Multnomah Channel. And anyway, he wrote his master's thesis on it. Subsequent mining applications, we had to contend with the allegation that mining would cause catastrophic flooding in high water situations. The testifier argued that a neighbor had dug a trench during a high water situation that created a geyser that lasted for a week and spewed water 6 feet up in the air. At about the eighth hearing that he made this allegation, somebody asked him if he'd seen it. He said, well, no, but the district manager told me. And the district manager said, no, I didn't see it, but one of the family that owns the land saw it. The guy happened to be sitting in the back of the room. And he said, no, that never happened. We dug a trench. There was a small boil, lasted a day. There was no geyser. As a result of all of this, allegation of catastrophic flooding, Cal Portland has had to construct and maintain extensive water monitoring for both of these sites that's ongoing 10 years after the first one and will go on in perpetuity because somebody was afraid of catastrophic flooding, which the scientists had all said was, you know, it's an uncontained aquifer of over 300 square miles. It's not going to happen. So that's the kind of testimony that we're concerned about.
Gotcha. Thank you. Neil, go right ahead.
I'm Neil Colbert, on Grand Island Road in Dayton, Oregon, a private citizen. The lobby for a multinational industry has successfully worked the legislature and subsequent rulemaking process to grant them de facto eminent domain over farmland zoning. And that's really square on the money what's going on here. They have the power, and nobody can question the zoning change. What they want now is to have that same power over the application process. When they complete a rulemaking process to grant them, when they complete a zoning conversion, the potential windfall profit is in the tens of millions of dollars. This power to lobby, make political contributions, and represent themselves at the all-important rulemaking process. Now, having got near absolute power over zoning, they want the same thing for the application. Having been through this process, I can say it is a very lopsided affair already. On one side, you have an industry that has decades of experience, both with the legal process and with dealing with local citizens who have no idea what is going on. By the time people understand what the real issues are, they have already been shut out of the process. I'll give you a few examples of what happened on Grand Island. The Baker Rock application had a large, complex study on flooding and pit capture. Only after public comment is over does it become clear that they did not look at the fact that the wing dam, built by the Corps of Engineers to close off the river channel that ran right through the proposed mine site, has failed completely and is largely done so since the last major flood. So we don't even know what will happen, and they didn't really address that. Two, an application in 2004 that had average trips per day condition on it used the Baker Rock process, the quasi-judicial hearing, to identify that the average was figured on a yearly basis. Well, that made the whole thing worthless. And by the way, the thing on that is all this trucking business. I can't testify on the bill that's here because I can't see it. But in the original version, there was a definite thing on the transportation. Well, all this local, local, local. Well, the site that's already approved is not local, and it's really no use going anymore because nobody cares. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jerome's still here. He's not. We have Bruce and, help me out.
Jason Brown.
Bruce and Jason Brown.
And Laura Masterson.
Laura Masterson, please come forward. Go ahead and begin.
Thank you, Representative Gillum. My name's Jason Brown, and I live in Polk County at 10725 Bridwell Road on a small farm. I'm testifying as a private citizen in opposition to this bill. My wife is a geologist teacher who got her PhD from Stanford, and I think that, well, I know that mining aggregate on the valley floor is really more than just about farmlands, or it should be, because doing this risks irreparable harm to aquifers, and you know it's something though that's very hard to demonstrate on the individual case, partially because there's a complete lack of detailed longitudinal data on our aquifers and our water tables in order to get any evidence from. And without the information being available, because we don't monitor the water table to the extent that we should, we're unable to really steward that key valuable resource to the degree that we should. So unless the Dash 3 places a moratorium on mining until we have adequate data, then I would say it probably doesn't address my concerns. So simply, we really need to be concerned about the aquifer. This is one of our most valuable resources. The aquifer in the valley floor is not the best aquifer in the world. And living on a small farm, you know, we have drought a couple months out of the year. We're not. We do have water concerns even in the Willamette Valley, despite what folks in California may think.
I agree. Please.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you for being here.
Representing Gillum, I'd like to first thank you for staying here and hearing us out.
Yeah.
You're the lone
survivor.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry for the long day.
I'm Bruce Chapin. I'm a third generation to farm in the Mission Bottom area north of Kaiser and serve as the chairman of the Oregon Farm Bureau Aggregate Committee. The original bill and the Dash 1 that I saw are both very radical bills and totally unacceptable. These bills have been rationalized by the Aggregate Committee claiming that the current process doesn't provide them with any certainty and that the farming community is easily able to block them.
To your point on that, do we have Dash 3s available?
We do not.
but we will.
We will.
For everyone. I'm so sorry they aren't available. You're within your purview to comment on what we did share with you. So I'm sorry. We'll try to have Dash-3s available soon. But go ahead,
Thank you.
Bruce.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, my observation has been just the opposite. What we've seen is the miners apply, the miners get the permit, irregardless of how much opposition there is from the community. In Mission Bottom, there was 3 applications, 3 approvals. Across the river, Grand Island, 3 applications, 3 approvals. A strong opposition in both cases. And this pattern has been continued throughout the valley and across the state. And we have data from DLC, which I've attached. And I want you to notice that I provide you with some objective data here. And I would like Rich Angstrom to also provide some objective data on the additional denials that he referenced, so we can all sit down and study them together. The bottom line, the data does not substantiate that the aggregate industry is being abused in this process, when they're only 3% being denied. I'm also somewhat familiar with one denial that was actually based on ORS 215-296, and that was Eugene Sand and Gravel application about 10 years ago. And the courts concluded it would significantly adversely affect the 2 fruit stands before they, so they couldn't be permitted. The conflicts in that case included loss of groundwater, increased flooding, dust on crops that can't be washed, dust causing increases in mice infestations, noise deterring farm market customers, and gravel traffic interfering with the customer's access. And I'd just like you to stop and think about those individual complaints or issues and how it stacks up against this existing bill, because the reason why I want to bring this to your attention is because this bill looks like it's really focusing at that case, because you go through the whole case and it denies or does not provide a balance for the farmer and the aggregate industry on those issues right down through the line.
Thank you.
So I appreciate the time.
And I appreciate your emphasis on balance, and it's a very hard one to find, but I agree with you. Next.
All right. I'll second Mr. Chapin's. Thank you for sticking it out with us and hearing us out. My name's Laura Masterson, and I'm here to oppose House Bill 2666 as amended. I'm an organic vegetable farmer with 50 acres of production in 3 counties in the Willamette Valley. I'm also on the board of a small nonprofit called Protect Grand Island Farms, and I have firsthand experience with how the conversion of EFU to mineral right zoning works. You guys have heard a little bit about Grand Island. I think several people have spoke eloquently about the challenges under the current state law in the most recent Grand Island case, despite tremendous testimony and extensive evidence of significant impacts to agriculture. The Yamhill County Commission approved a 3rd quarry on the island. From an agricultural perspective, the laws protecting farmland from conversion should be strengthened. Our group feels strongly, and this bill is really headed in the wrong direction. So that was my Grand Island or nonprofit hat. I'm going to switch hats here for a second. I'm also a vice chair on the Oregon State Board of Agriculture, and I'd like to share, or I have shared with you, the resolution relating to aggregate that the board passed in 2011. It is siting of aggregate mining operations in the Willamette Valley is the title. It's resolution number 300. You have it in front of you, so I won't read all the whereases for you, but basically at the heart of it is aggregate mines are focused in the floodplain soils, which are some of the best farmland in the Willamette Valley. Farming on poor soils is not an option for agriculture, and typically mines are taken out of agriculture production, mined, and then reclaimed as wildlife habitat, which removes this land from farming forever. The resolution does not support conversion of Class 1 and Class 2 soils to aggregate unless no reasonable alternative exists. So I just wanted to give you that information, share that information with you, and say thanks again for
the long day. Thank you for submitting this to the record. Ian, do we have anybody else? Did I miss
I don't
anybody?
Believe so.
Anybody else wanted to speak to this bill? Thank you all Thank you. Very, very much. With that, I will close the hearing, but do I need to roll anything over to make sure?
You don't. We've okay. done that.
But before I do, I apologize again for the late hour. If I were in charge, this legislature would have about 1/4 the bills that we have. But I'm not. I'm in charge of this part of the dais for a few minutes. That's it. But I do thank you all for your testimony. This is a difficult bill, but that's what we're here for. And I look forward to sharing the information with my colleagues. With that, I will, if I'm correct, Ian,
close the
public hearing on House Bill 2666 and adjourn this meeting unless there's any objection. I see none. It's closed. I see none. It's closed.